Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to Cure Talks. This is Priya Menon, your host, joining you from India. And today we are talking about prostate cancer. All prostate cancer talks and Cure Talks are conducted in association with Prostate Cancer International and the Prostate Cancer Foundation. As we all know, the Broad Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is one of the most sophisticated bioscience and biotechnology research centers in North America. A new initiative that the Broad Institute is coordinating is a metastatic prostate cancer project. And today we have with us Dr. Eli Van Allen from Broad Institute talking about the project and how a patient can contribute his personal genetic, genomic, and clinical data to the development of the world's most comprehensive database on advanced prostate cancer. Dr. Van Allen is associate member at the Broad Institute, assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and holds clinical positions at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Cambridge and Boston, Massachusetts. He is the principal investigator for the Metastatic Prostate Cancer Project. Welcome to Cure Talks, Dr. Van Allen.
Thanks for having me.
This panel is led by Mike Scott. Mike is co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International, a prostate cancer-specific, not-for-profit educational and informational organization based in Virginia. He is a former chairman of the board of the National Organization for Rare Disorders and is also board member of the International Myeloma Foundation. Joining Mike are prostate cancer advocates Joel Novak, Jan Manorite, and Paul Carpenter. Paul is a patient advocate for men diagnosed with prostate cancer. He has contributed to dozens of online groups and forums, and he co-founded a Los Angeles support group for gay and bisexual men living with prostate cancer. Jan is Executive Vice President of Prostate Cancer International and works along with Mike to implement free projects and programs for patients and caregivers through Prostate Cancer InfoLink. Joel Novak is a founder of Cancer ABCs and survivor of five primary cancers, including thyroid, recurrent metastatic prostate cancer, renal cancer, melanoma, appendiceal cancer, as well as autoimmune disease and ankylosing spondylitis. I extend a very warm welcome to everyone on the panel. Thank you for being here with us today. Before Mike begins with the discussion, I would like to remind our audience that we will be addressing questions towards the end of the talk. Dial in using 718-664-6574 and press 1 on your telephone keypad to let us know if you have a question for Dr. Van Allen. Alternately, you can post your questions on curetalks.com or email them to priya@trialx.com. With that, Mike, it's all yours.
Thank you very much indeed, Priya, for the introduction. Good afternoon, Dr. Van Allen. It's a pleasure to have you on the phone today. Perhaps the most sensible thing is for you to take about 10 or 15 minutes and just give us your overview of the Metastatic Prostate Cancer Project. I know that it goes beyond metastatic and you're really looking at patients with almost any form of advanced disease. And I know that you've done similar projects in breast cancer and rarer forms of cancer. So with that introduction, perhaps you could give us an initial overview and we'll start thinking of questions we want to ask you.
Absolutely. So first, again, I want to thank you, Priya, the entire organizing committee for giving me this chance to present and share our project with this forum, and to say what a privilege it is to sort of be able to do this and be sort of representing the group. And I think I was thinking about sort of what's the best way to sort of frame the Metastatic Prostate Cancer Project and what we're trying to do. And I think the best way to do this may actually be to sort of rewind a little bit and sort of lead you and the rest of the group in terms of how we got here and why this patient-driven metastatic prostate cancer project is so critical to help us take a big leap forward in discoveries for men fighting this disease, for their families, and so on. So to take a quick step back, you know, we in my group, you know, at the Broad Institute, at Dana-Farber, where I work patients clinically across numerous other contexts, are very interested in understanding the genetics of cancer, because we think the genetics of cancer can tell us about, you know, why does cancer arise, and then the genetics of advanced cancer can tell us why does cancer become resistant to the drugs that we have, and how can we use that information to figure out what, you know, what the next kinds of therapies are we'd want to develop to give to patients, and to hopefully improve care and, you know, hopefully get towards the thing we're all striving for, which is trying to cure cancer really across the board. And it's been sort of the one of the privileges of my sort of one of the honors of my career so far to really be able to participate in these genetic profiling studies that have, in essence, sort of laid the map of the genetics of many different cancers. You know, the ones that I've been deeply involved with are predominantly in prostate cancer, but these also include, you know, melanoma, breast cancer, you know, lung cancer, and so on and so forth. And we've learned quite a few things about, you know, for instance, in prostate cancer, you know, when we study the genetics of so-called primary prostate cancer, why, what is the difference between a prostate cancer and a patient, you know, DNA that they were born with? And we've, you know, sort of studied that, you know, to great length so far, and have really sort of laid that map out pretty extensively. About 4 or 5 years ago, as part of a large consortium effort funded by the Prostate Cancer Foundation and Stand Up to Cancer, again, I was sort of very fortunate to join a large team science effort whereby we wanted to apply the same kind of genetic studies, but rather than looking at, you know, local prostate cancer, so prostate cancer that's treated with surgery or radiation and hormone therapy, rather look at more advanced prostate cancer, castration-resistant prostate cancer that is, you know, that is resistant to the drugs that we have, and thinking that, you know, if we can look at the genetics of that, those tumors, we could actually, you know, make great strides towards understanding what are the things we need to drug, what are the new therapies we need to go after, what are the right combinations, what are the right, you know, patients that need to be treated with the right combinations, so on and so forth. And so as a consortium effort spanning 8 different institutions, we embarked on this effort together, and, you know, it took, you know, some number of years, but we accrued the first roughly 150 men with advanced castration-resistant prostate cancer that we could get tumor biopsies on. We did, you know, comprehensive genetic analysis, and we laid the first map of advanced prostate cancer, and this was something we reported on a couple of years ago. And this was a really important study because it identified multiple, you know, discoveries that we frankly could never have anticipated going into this. You know, that, for instance, about 20% of men with advanced prostate cancer have mutations in these so-called DNA repair genes that might indicate, you know, potential for platinum chemotherapy or PARP inhibitors. Other men may have mutations in other genes that may lead to targeted therapy usage and so on. And we've since sort of continued to accrue in that project and move along. The reason I sort of lay out this pathway is that, so we made those discoveries in 2015. And in 2015, at the Broad Institute, we also started experimenting with a novel idea, because that research project that I described was really sort of a traditional research project. It was a top-down initiative developed by researchers at famous academic institutions that in whom the protocols were developed and studies were designed, and things sort of trickled down, and eventually a patient was involved only because the patient had the tumor and was going through the biopsy and therefore needed to be involved at a critical juncture. And that was sort of how most of research has been being done. But at the Broad, we had this idea that maybe we can flip this whole concept of how research is done on its head. And rather than sort of engage with the patient at almost the last step, we start at the day from day one and build research projects hand in hand with patients. Rather than rely on patients by chance walking into one of a few very large academic medical centers, we find the patients where they are using social media, using websites, using the ability that we have to actually mail kits to patients' homes, and so that they can contribute their genetic information or their DNA to us directly, and see if we can sort of flip the whole concept of how we do research on its head. And the first initiative that was launched was actually launched at around the same time that our sort of first wave of discoveries in advanced prostate cancer was reported, so roughly like summer or fall 2015. And this was in metastatic breast cancer, and the project is called the Metastatic Breast Cancer Project. And you know, I described that we spent a few years to study 150 men with prostate cancer. It took us a long time. It was very difficult. You know, in this breast cancer project, in the order of about a couple of years, we've been able to obtain consents and go after tumors of over 4,000 women and men across the United States with metastatic breast cancer who are willing to say, count me in, I want to participate in this research. We built the whole mechanism such that it resonated with those patients because it was, in essence, written by the patients. And it's been instrumental in guiding discoveries in that context. And I sort of watching that with in awe and naturally then saying, gosh, you know, maybe we can do the same thing, but do this for metastatic prostate cancer. And that is really sort of the impetus for the Metastatic Prostate Cancer Project, which is a patient-driven research initiative that has been built by patients in sort of in close collaboration with patients, patient advocates, and many, many folks who sort of aren't normally sort of at the table of research projects on day one. And the goal here is really to actually sort of just take one huge step forward in terms of the number of patients we can actually study, the types of patients we can study, and the mechanisms that which we can with which we can engage with patients to do research together. And I think what's been so amazing to see is that, you know, we launched this project about a month ago. And, you know, I mentioned that it took, you know, for the first wave of discovery of trying to study men with advanced prostate cancer, it took 3 or 4 years, all these different groups working together. It was rather challenging and so on to get 150 patients to be willing to be participating in such a study. In about a month, we have approached 250 men who've said, count me in, who've proceeded to provide consent through a website, through in whom we've sent out kits, saliva kits, and blood biopsy kits, which I'll explain in a little bit later, and are starting to actually receive these things back. And the ability to sort of accelerate research that would normally take years and years and years on the order of literally like 3 or 4 weeks is something that I still find mind-boggling, and something that I would say as a scientist I could not imagine would even be feasible. But it's something that's happening now, and that's, I think, sort of what the power of patient-driven research really is all about, is that we can actually do a research project that would normally take years and years and years on the order of weeks to months, and thereby accelerate the pace of discovery, make better sense of all of the mutations that we see in this patient population to help guide further drug development, combination clinical trials, new treatment pathways for patient populations, bigger discoveries, and so on and so forth, and thereby, you know, move the needle forward much faster than frankly I could have ever imagined.
So Dr. Van Allen, if I am a patient and I run across information about the project and I get to the website and I read through the stuff and I tend to click on the link and say, sure, sign me up, what are the next steps that happen?
So, sorry, I was a little fuzzy, but if your question was, is if you go to the website and you read through the information and you click the Count Me In button, what happens next is that you're asked a series of questions about your disease, and you then, you know, you click a few buttons that basically describe the project that you're agreeing to participate in, and then, you know, and then the next thing you know, you'll get an email confirmation about this, and you know, a few days later, you'll get FedEx box of a box that's a saliva kit in the mail, and that will sort of that you can then provide your saliva that we can then use to study your DNA.
That's the same as if I signed up for 23andMe or if I signed up for Ancestry or, you know, any of the other sort of services.
Correct.
Like that. Simple saliva kit.
Simple saliva kit is the first premise. Now, there's two key things to be clear on here, and I think it's worth sort of being very transparent about, is that this is a research project. And while our ultimate goal and frankly much of what 2018 is all about is actually figuring out the logistics of, is to create a mechanism that we can actually provide individualized results back, like even if they're not really about you know, clinical medicine, 23andMe, Ancestry.com, those kinds of things will provide something back. We can't do that right now. We can provide aggregate results back, that, you know, sort of information, discoveries that we've learned from this study that anyone who participates in can hand to their doctor. But I just want to be clear on that point. The other part of this study that we think is pretty exciting is that, unlike some of the prior direct-to-patient initiatives that we've already launched, in this patient population, most men, you know, may not even have a biopsy that we can use from their tumor that we can actually study the genetics of. And so, with this study, we're experimenting with actually mailing out what's called blood biopsy kits. And the idea here is that with a simple blood vial, a vial of blood rather, we can actually find the genetics of the tumor in the blood, and study that rather than, you know, what was usually done, which is trying to track down a biopsy that might be here or there or impossible to find. And the way that works is that with the saliva kit, you spit into the tube and then you put it right back in the mail. With the blood biopsy kit, you bring the blood, that kit to your regular clinic appointment, and they'll just, you know, help you get that one extra tube of blood that you put back in the mail and send back to us. And it's as simple as that.
So I can do that when I just go for a PSA test or something.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. And when I sign up, am I telling you who my doctor is so that they will know I'm involved in this project?
Yes. And so absolutely. So one thing we want to be clear on is that the goal here is obviously not to sort of circumvent the patient-doctor relationship, and in fact, we are working closely with multiple physicians to sort of make sure this project also resonates with doctors, and we want to work closely with them in that regard. And indeed, you know, part of the goal here is also not to not only generate the genetic information, but also understand the clinical information so we can, you know, make those discoveries even faster and, in essence, put the genetics in some kind of context. So for that, we need to know where the patient's being treated and whatnot, so we can get that information. But it's pretty simple, and that also is part of the same, you know, online experience that patients go through when they consent for the project.
So let me ask you a truly simple question, probably stupid question. You said that, you know, you weren't going to be able to sort of tell me exactly what this project might be able to do for me, but you would be able to tell me some things. So would that be the sort of thing that you were able to say, we found that 80% of patients who have a metastasis, a visceral metastasis in their liver, have this sort of genetic abnormality, or Y percent have something else? Do you see what I'm saying?
Exactly. Yes. And so you're exactly right. And we think that, you know, it's that kind of information, one, that can be immediately actionable if presented to a physician who may not be as genomically aware, if that's a phrase. And, you know, so that in and of itself is quite valuable. And two, I believe, you know, one thing we feel strongly about is that, you know, being realistic, that, you know, research is hard and it can be frustrating sometimes, but we believe that a part of our goal here is a sort of an altruistic goal to really help the future. And there really is sort of something that we feel strongly about, that we know a lot of the men who we talk to who are working with us on these projects feel strongly about, is that, you know, this may not ever actually help me, but these findings may actually be the thing that helps my brothers or my sons or my grandkids. And I think that's part of the goal here is recognizing how important that aspect of it is as well.
So let me see if I can just get a couple of other things clear, and then I'm going to throw this open to other members of the panel. What you'd like to think we could do is, within a couple of years, get something like 2,000 to 4,000 men for whom you've had both blood samples and saliva samples that you've been able to test. And when you've got all that data, what what do you do with all that data? I mean, my understanding is you're going to be able to share that with other researchers in some way.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So, and actually, we won't even wait that long. So as soon as we get, you know, we actually already even have in our whiteboard in our office, we have sort of a planned, our goal is to actually have generated enough data that we would make our first public release of just to be clear, of de-identified data, so not information that can be traced back to anyone for privacy issues, but have our first release for the community, you know, by fall of 2018, so by fall of this year. And the reason is that, you know, a lot of times these kinds of research projects are met with some skepticism by patients because they may hear that so-and-so wants to study their tumors and create sort of a resource that kind of is almost becomes like a silo that that it only gets released when, you know, some researcher decides to do so. And I think we feel like that is completely opposed to what we and understandably every patient would want, which is to make this data available to the entire community as fast as possible, such that even if we can't put the whole puzzle together ourselves, so maybe somebody else can. And we want to enable that as quickly as possible. And indeed, towards that end, you know, in the metastatic breast cancer project, we already have sort of proof in the pudding in that we've, you know, now made a public release of the first 100 patients with both molecular data, genetic data, and clinical data that's sort of been released without any of the usual things that come that are expected from a researcher's perspective, because it's so important that the community know that we're serious about just, you know, making it available for the entire community as a resource to use. And we actually were trying to really strongly encourage everyone to use it because we think that's the fastest way to make discoveries happen.
So you are going to be following up with my doctor. Once you've got the samples, you're going to be following up with my doctor to say, can you give me details about his treatment to date so that you can correlate that in some way to the rest of the data? Is that my understanding?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. I see. Okay. So let me throw this open to a couple of others, and perhaps we should begin with Joel, since he has every known form of cancer under the sun, and he'll want you to do projects in all of them. So Joel is the president of Cancer ABCs, and Joel, the project is all yours. Go ahead.
Every known form of cancer under the sun, and he'll want you to do projects in all of them. Joel,
hi, Joel. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
We can hear you.
I think Joel has his computer on in the background, maybe.
No, I don't. I just have my phone.
Okay.
Somebody has a computer on.
Let me know when I can go.
Go.
No, I don't. I just have my phone.
Hello, Joel, please.
Okay, so first I want to thank Dr. Van Allen so much for participating tonight, and actually more importantly for being the mastermind, you know, along with the rest of the team of this fantastic project. So thank you so much to you and the entire team. I'm really excited about it. Because it's going to make such important information available. Now, we talk a lot about personalized medicine, and people should understand that this is really a really important giant step in moving us towards personalized medicine, being able to understand the genetics of your particular tumor, and being able to figure out what the best treatments are, but it's going to take a while. So I do know that some men, just wanted to throw this out, have had problems getting their blood samples taken. But I think I just want to let you know that when I had a problem when I went to a lab for my PSA test, I just waited until the next time I was at my doctor's office, and he just drew it or had it drawn. So, you know, difficult thing. So I did want to share that. And I also, wanted to ask Dr. Van Allen if you would, you have talked a little bit about it, about the return of aggregate data. Can you give us an example of what aggregate data would look like and what perhaps an individual's doctor and they could perhaps do or think about that data?
Absolutely. So first, Joel, obviously, so thank you and Jan and the rest of the patient and patient advocates who are the real champions of this project. I think, you know, again, I mean that sincerely, you know, this is, and you guys know this because you guys were, even to back to pointing out, you know, embarrassing spelling mistakes that I made way back when on how these things are actually built. It's the kind of things that, like, you know, we just don't, as researchers, always are blinded to, but you guys are sort of so quick to jump on, but it's the most important thing. So thank you guys. In terms of sort of aggregate results, it's a great question. So I think the best example to keep it in metastatic prostate cancer is, you know, when we made an observation in our 2015 study that 20% of men had mutations. Men with advanced prostate cancer had mutations in DNA repair genes. And what we could do with that, as soon as we found that, even though we couldn't trace it back to the individuals that had those events, that finding sort of can be distilled into a very simple blurb and could be handed to any physician who would then, with an argument to state, you know, that's 1 in 5 men with advanced prostate cancer have a mutation in something that may not only change the course of my clinical care and the drugs that you might want to give me, but also in some cases, especially for men who have these mutations in their so-called inherited genome or their germline gene, the DNA that they were born with, may have implications for my family, which means, you know, we can then make a very strong case to your physician, you need to do genetic testing for me. And so even though we don't have the results for any one individual, that finding can, you know, in essence became the thing that changed practice immediately as far as we're concerned for both the patient, all the patients that came forward after that study, but also for those who you may have been involved in that study, didn't know, but you could immediately take that, you know, that distilled blurb down and hand it to their physician and say, based off of this, I need you to do these certain tests. And so that's the power of the aggregate information, even though it may not be personalized to one individual at the moment, it still is, it's profoundly important, and actually even stronger than it would be if it was just one individual's information, because it's sort of part of a larger set of data that we can feel much more confident about.
So in essence, the issues about this project benefiting my children and my brothers, there also is a possibility that I may in turn or as a participant directly benefit in a period, in obviously not immediately, not tomorrow, but in some time in the future. Also, I just want to point out, I don't think you mentioned the webpage. How do people get involved or find out more information?
Oh, yeah.
Don't want you to forget, that's important.
Right, yeah, sorry. So, of course, thank you for that. So it's very straightforward. It's www.mpcproject.org. M as in Mary, P as in Paul, C as in Cat, project.org. And, you know, or you can just Google Metastatic Prostate Cancer Project, should get you there. And to your first question, yes. So even, we think the pace of discovery is getting so fast. And, you know, things that used to take decades or take 5-plus years can be shrunken down in terms of, like, to months, if not years. And so we think it's entirely feasible that these kinds of discoveries could happen in that time frame for this project. And so we do believe that there's a chance of what you just described. But we also want to say that, you know, there's so many other sort of benefits as well, I guess is what I would say.
Thank you.
So this is Paul Carpenter. I had a couple of questions for you, Dr.
Great.
Van Allen.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm very grateful to you for doing this. This is the sort of bottom-up thing that I've been pushing doctors and researchers to do for years, and I wish Tony Crispino were also on the line because he and I are very much like this way. I would wonder if the biopsy and pathology slides might be even more valuable than the blood vials, and for those who have them and that they're relatively fresh, would that be something that you could use?
So, one, I'm thrilled to hear you say that, you know, that this is something you're excited about. And I think, you know, for those of us in the research world, we're so used to sort of the old-fashioned way of doing this, of science, that we, you know, the notion of saying, like, you know, start with the patients and have them drive the project still feels like something that, when you, depending on who you ask, may sound like something that's a little bit out there. So it's great
actually,
to hear the enthusiasm.
Well, we have been doing this for quite some time, but it hasn't been under the aegis of scientific research. Were you aware of the Yananao project, for example, where thousands of men with prostate cancer just shared their stories? And it was not just community, but lots of valuable information. Anyway, please, you have the floor.
But yes, so actually, those are the kinds of things that we want to sort of then channel into genetics and science. And in terms of your question, so I didn't mean to say that we were we were discarding or not gonna attempt to study the pathology slides and the tumor biopsies that were done. Indeed, we actually, when possible, will very much attempt to do so. But we just recognize that oftentimes, practically, that's not feasible.
Right.
Because, you know, men may have gotten a biopsy 10, 15 years ago in a urology clinic that may not even be open anymore before they end up developing a more advanced disease. And so they may not ever get another biopsy. And so there are just instances where it's not possible. But indeed, when possible, we would definitely be keen to study that as well.
For example, I would think the most valuable set of comparisons you could get would be someone who had pre-castration-resistant prostate cancer, and then a year or so later, it becomes castration resistant. What changed? Everything
exactly.
else is the same except for that gene or those genes. That would be wonderful to get.
Exactly, and indeed, we actually have done some of that already.
Excellent.
And the sample size, the number of patients in whom we were actually able to do that successfully, was very small. So in one study that we recently reported, it was 7 men.
Right.
But what's so compelling about that approach is that in those 7 men, we found enough of a signal about involving a gene called CDK4 and CDK6. There's 2 genes that actually have drugs that are in development, in this case for breast cancer. So we have immediately then gone back to the company and said, hey, you know, here's an indication in prostate cancer that you need to jump on immediately, and have translated that into what's going to hopefully be a clinical trial in the not-too-distant future. And that was 7 men. So you know, we by no means have exhausted the potential to make those kinds of discoveries and translate that into immediately, you know, compelling trials and opportunities and therapies with that we could not have predicted in any other way. So yes, I completely agree. That's within the scope of what we're trying to do here,
right.
and something we're hoping to do again in partner with patients.
That sounds great. I had several other questions, but I'm not the only person here. I yield to Jan or Joel or Mike if you have something.
Yeah. Hey, this is Jan. Hi, Dr. Van Allen.
Hey, Jan.
How are you? Hi. Again, thanks for being on, and thanks for Mike and Priya for doing this. You know me, I always try to think like a patient, which I am not one, but I was a caregiver. So I was really interested in the comment you made about the finding of approximately 20% of men, 1 out of 5, had a specific finding when they were advanced. And I know you said DNA something. I wonder if you could repeat that, and then I want to ask a question that goes with it, if that's okay.
Absolutely. So what we found is that in studying the genetics of men with advanced prostate cancer, whether it's the genetics of the tumor itself or the genetics of the DNA that the person was born with from their parents, about 20 or so percent have genetic changes or mutations in a set of genes that are sort of that we categorize as with so-called DNA repair genes are more commonly known. Some of them are known in breast cancer, in the breast cancer world, like the BRCA gene that Angelina Jolie sort of was very vocal about. It's all part of that same family.
So if I'm a patient and I hear you say this, I would go to my medical oncologist and I would ask him to give me this hereditary genetic testing.
So
what do I ask
my
doctor? Yeah,
you would if you have advanced prostate cancer, you could ask your doctor for both hereditary genetic testing and tumor testing. And those are, to be clear, those are 2 different tests.
Right.
One would be of the blood of if you're the DNA that you were born with from your parents, One would be of the tumor biopsy that you may have had from some time ago.
So the blood tests tend to show you what you've carried your whole life. Testing the
exactly.
tumor shows you specifically what your tumor is expressing, and they can be two very different things for a patient, correct?
Correct, exactly.
Okay. If I could ask a follow-up question, and I know there was a consensus conference in Philadelphia last year and something released in Journal of Clinical Oncology, I think February this year, talking about some of this stuff. So I feel like genetic counselors are going to be our new medical professional, and I feel like we're going to overwhelm them real soon. But I wonder if you have any insight on finding a genetic counselor or working with one.
Yes, so you're absolutely
yeah.
right. And I think one thing we've already seen, you know, in our hospital here at Dana-Farber, that, you know, all the genetic counselors who are sort of trained for many years in breast and ovarian cancer all of a sudden have a lot of guys knocking on their door that we're sending their way. And I think we're rapidly stressing the system here, and this is a place where there are many genetic counselors around. We know that they're difficult to find in general. Our hope is that what we're trying to do is actually empower physicians like oncologists and other caregivers who may not to sort of typically be involved in that kind of aspect of a patient's care to become more involved when there is no available genetic counseling service that's feasible to access. And then we're
okay.
also looking into opportunities for you know telegenetic counseling and other means of sort of bringing the genetic counselors to the patients when the patients can't get to a genetic counselor in person. This also speaks to why it's actually hard to. We want to make sure when we bring the genetic testing to patients as part of this research project that we can actually, we don't want to actually do the aspect of the project that gives individualized results back until we can figure out how to solve that problem. For example, in addition to many other logistical issues. So you raise a very important point that the royal we in the medical community are still trying to figure out how to solve.
Yeah, I think we're at a fast pace, and we're just going to have to find solutions as we go. One last question. The key to this project is, in real simple terms, numbers. Numbers, numbers, numbers. So anybody who goes on to mpcproject.org can find the Facebook page also at the bottom. And if this is something you want to share on Facebook and just get more awareness out, it's pretty easy to do on Facebook.
Yeah, and I would echo Jan's point on this. You know, the reason why the Metastatic Breast Cancer Project has been able to sort of accelerate that whole field and get so many thousands of women and men to sign up is not because, you know, myself and the others on the team sort of are famous people and have pushed it forward. It's because patients are sharing it with other patients, and patient caregivers are sharing it with other patients and other caregivers. And sort of it's happening in a very organic way, and we believe that that model, you know, is sort of the right way to do things if what this is supposed to be is a patient-driven project. So if you go to mpcproject.org and it's something you're interested in doing, you can also have a mechanism to either share it via Facebook, via Twitter, via email, via whatever capacity that you're sort of comfortable with. And that's, we think that organic strategy is sort of the right path forward here.
So this might
Dr.
be the
Van
right
Allen,
time.
Can I ask
Please
you
go ahead.
Go ahead. Oh, thank you. I was just going to say, is this study intended to be longitudinal in nature? So, in other words, I give you, you get my genetic material and so forth, and my medical records, and then, of course, in 6 months or a year, there's a change, or I have a new biopsy. Are you interested in collecting that data, and is there a system set up for that?
So yes and yes. So we're very interested in that, and for the reasons that, in part, that Paul had mentioned, because I think there's huge value in studying that to help inform, you know, drugs and therapies and trials and whatnot. The mechanism is actually going to be twofold. We will obviously try to go after the formal records, but we think here again there's power. The patients have the power, and we're developing sort of repeat surveys that patients have a chance to provide their own voice and provide patient-reported data on where they're at with their disease, what's happening in their life, and actually in so doing, not only help solve the problem you just described, but actually in some cases can even just prompt research questions that we never would have thought of that are sort of become up to the forefront of the science we'd like to pursue because they're the kind of things that we're just listening to what patients are telling us here and sort of guiding the science based off of that.
So Dr. Van Allen, thank you. I just have one more quick question, and then I'm going to let Priya see if we've got questions from the audience. You've called it the Metastatic Prostate Cancer Project, mpcproject.org, but my understanding is you're actually accepting pretty much any form of advanced prostate cancer patients. Can you just make sure we're all clear about that?
Yes. So I think and our goal here is really to think about prostate cancer that's left the gland, and from our perspective, counts as sort of, you know, not localized prostate cancer. And so, you know, the naming is always a little bit tricky in this disease. Is it advanced? Is it metastatic? But I think from our perspective, we're very keen to study men sort of along that entire spectrum of folks who in whom prostate cancer has left the gland. And that could be, you know, lymph nodes. That could be biochemical recurrence only. That could be, you know, bone metastases, liver metastases, you know, and so on.
Right. So basically, if you've got any form of progressive disease, you are eligible to participate.
Yes. And okay. Also should add that, you know, there's folks who, you know, it's been so the outpouring of interest from folks who don't necessarily have metastatic prostate cancer, but who have come across our site, you know, there are ways to participate still in terms of providing, you know, patient-reported information that, you know, maybe we can't sort of act on right this moment, but it's the kind of thing that could easily become something that can turn into a project down the road. And so, you know, that's okay too.
Okay, so Priya, I'm going to hand it back to you in case we've got calls on the line.
Thank you, Mike. listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Van Allen, please press 1 on your keypads and let us know. The number to dial in is 718-664-6574. If you've already posted your questions on our website, we are going to be addressing them now. Jan has been really great. She's taken time out and answered quite a few of our questions for us, so thank you so much, Jan. Doctor, I will be reading them out so that you can probably just give quick answers to the ones the questions that have been posted. The first one says, I have metastatic prostate cancer, which is currently well under control. And there's an initially ADT, docetaxel, followed by prostatectomy, lymphadenectomy, and now he's under Zoladex, enzalutamide, and denosumab. And PSA is less than 0.01. So he says, 2 years ago after prostatectomy, I had a sample of the cancer tissue from the prostate tested for BRCA1 and 2, and the test was positive for BRCA2. A test of my blood, which I did a year later, came back negative. That is no germline BRCA1 or 2. Would you expect that metastasis would also show BRCA2 mutation and hence, if necessary, be treatable with a PARP inhibitor?
So that's a great question. I think it also sort of exposes the challenges in the current state of challenges in understanding what these different genetic tests are. Because it sounds like this individual has had both the sort of inherited DNA test and the tumor test for genetics. So those two tests that Jan was asking me about a few moments ago, and that the BRCA2 mutation is only in the tumor test, not in the inherited DNA test. So what we're learning, and this is all happening in real time, is that men who have these mutations from either test seem to be more likely to respond to both PARP inhibitors and to a class of chemotherapies called platinum chemotherapy. So that may be the case in this context. I'll just stress, though, that this patient described that, you know, things are currently well under control, which is fantastic, and there's no indication to necessarily do anything right now. The other thing I'll state is that we're still learning how best to use these therapies, and there's many clinical trials that are open for men with those kinds of genetics, so it always sort of encourage anyone who's interested and has access to consider a clinical trial, because the only way we're going to learn and put this whole puzzle together is actually through patient participation in that context as well.
Thank you, Doctor. Our next listener question is, says, now it appears that the immune response produced by ablation combined with intratumoral injection of immunotherapy agents such as Yervoy, Opdivo, and Keytruda can create a highly effective anti-cancer immune response with eradication of cancer even beyond the directly treated site. He wants to know if anyone is familiar with this approach to metastatic prostate cancer, which has been performed by Dr. Jason Williams.
So there are studies underway or sort of in progress looking at some of these immunotherapy agents that were listed here and their relative utility in metastatic prostate cancer. The reality thus far has been the results have been pretty disappointing. Most men have not responded, although some do, and actually one of the questions that we can actually potentially address in the metastatic prostate cancer project is sort of what is unique about the genetics of those men, because some of these men are participating in this project and have self-reported that they've received these therapies. So I'm not particularly familiar with the specific approach by the website listed, but I think, again, more generally, there are actually quite a few clinical trials happening in various places where people are trying to study these drugs in metastatic prostate cancer better, and so any opportunity to participate in those may help us all put this puzzle together. But again, I'd also state that, men are getting these therapies in the community, in the real world, by one way or another, and any men who want to go to mpcproject.org and participate in our study can actually help us help inform that puzzle as well, and actually help figure out what's different, because that could guide how we use these drugs for all men with metastatic prostate cancer.
Thank you, Doctor. We just got a question. I've submitted a sputum and blood sample. Will I get any personal results, or are they all wrapped up in general non-specific summary? The question just came in now.
Great. So that's a great question and speaks to what one of the key things here is that, for the mpcproject.org, at the moment, it is purely a research study, which means as we make discoveries, we can present the aggregate results of the, tens, hundreds, or thousands of men in whom we have data that we can provide back to the participants who could then take that information to their doctor and ask about relevance. At the moment, we are not able to return individualized results from an individual patient's genetics back to that patient. But it is something we're obviously very keen to try to figure out how to do and are working towards over the course of this next year.
So, Dr. Van Allen, just to follow up on that, so what I think I hear you're saying is that it might be possible, if it starts to look like a good idea, to be able to provide those results back to their physician. Is that where you think you might be going?
So it's a great question. It's all still a work in progress because we, one, don't want to intervene between the sacred patient-physician relationship. Two, want to be able to provide a test that sort of meets the clinical grade criteria that are needed to be a real test that can be used for patient care. And three, want to do it in as a responsible way. And so all of those things are challenges that we as a community need to overcome so that we can do this effectively. It is something we're very keen to build towards, and we're working very hard behind the scenes to figure this all out. But for now, this project and the other Count Me In projects are purely research projects.
I see. Okay, thank you. Priya, you're back up. Sorry.
Thank you, Mike. So, Doctor, the next question, I know it's slightly away from the topic that we're discussing, but the person refers to an article on tapeworm drug that fights prostate cancer. And he wants to know if there are any opinions on using nitazoxanide for the treatment of prostate cancer with a Gleason score of 7 and PSA of 5.61.
Hey, sorry, and the agent, I didn't catch the agent. Can you repeat that question?
Nitazoxanide.
Nitazoxanide.
Oh, nitazoxanide.
Yeah, right. Thank you, Paul.
You know, there's it's not something that I think we feel like is we have enough information on as being relevant for patients, especially those, it sounds like, who have what's called local prostate cancer, who in whom it has not spread outside the gland, you know, it does sort of actually sort of present an interesting – it is an interesting question because it's sort of part of the – it's the kind of information, because patients are oftentimes taking things like this, perhaps even without telling their doctor, but it's the kind of thing that they're self-reporting in the surveys that we're getting as part of the MPC project initial launch, that could represents the kind of things that we didn't even realize we had the potential to ask. You know, so for instance, does, you know, are there certain interventions that men are doing, either dietary exercise, off-label therapeutic, you know, atypical medications, that they would tell us that we could actually link to the tumor genetics and whatnot, which are completely uncharted territory scientifically, but and are the kind of things that are hard to study through a traditional research program, but are exactly the kind of things that we can actually try to do here. And so all the more reason why we're very keen to sort of cast as wide a net as possible and provide a mechanism for men to actually share all the things that they're doing that oftentimes don't end up in the medical record, that their doctor may never write down in a clinic note, but the patient themselves, using their own voice, can share with us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Doctor. Paul, you had some questions for Dr. Van Allen. Please go ahead and ask them.
Okay, sure. This one's a simple one. Is the blood sample affected by the medications the patient might be taking? And by that, I mean the genome, of course.
That's a great question. Actually, I think it's a question we don't scientifically really know the answer to. We know that if the drug is working, then it'll be less likely for us to find the tumor DNA in the blood. Other than that, we actually don't know the answer to that question for almost any cancer therapy that we give to in any context in any cancer. So the short answer is we don't know, but we'd love – that's the kind of question that, you know, could easily be sparked by this kind of an effort.
Okay. I was surprised by the answer, so I'm glad I asked it. So in other words, more people, more data.
More data, exactly. Points. Yes.
Yeah. I was also interested – this is probably something you can't really answer – but how could you correct for sample bias, especially in aggregate data, when chances are good that the samples you get are more likely well-educated, perhaps a little more affluent patients, and other patients may be less well-served? And, of course, that's been a problem in medical research forever.
So I'm actually thrilled you asked that question, because I think it speaks to one of the most important things we're trying to do with both the Metastatic Prostate Cancer Project and the other Count Me In projects. And you hit the nail on the head. You know, this kind of research is embarrassingly skewed towards Caucasian patient populations, oftentimes of sort of middle upper class socioeconomic status, and generally we have very little understanding of the differences, either genetic or otherwise, that help contribute to cancers, either, you know, as they arise or as they become metastatic. In other patient populations, and this is especially important in prostate cancer, because we know clinically that men of African descent, for example, have, you know, oftentimes present with more aggressive prostate cancer at a younger age, that's less responsive to therapies, and therefore they're more likely to die, and we don't understand why, but almost very few men who are African American who have prostate cancer have been studied, and that is, there's many reasons for that. But some of them may be simple as, you know, again, it comes back to, well, do those men go to the, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 cancer centers that we typically conduct these kinds of research programs in? And the answer is usually no. And so a mechanism like the Metastatic Prostate Cancer Project, which anyone with an internet connection can actually log into and sign up for, is a way around that. But to your point, it's insufficient in and of itself, because there's still probably a lot of men who may not, for whom that may be a barrier. And
right.
So we're actually working with some of the members of our Patient Advisory Council to come up with strategies to actually bring, for instance, either flyers about the study to, you know, other places where folks congregate that we can actually tap into these communities, whether it's, you know, church groups or support networks or whatnot, and try to socialize these projects in places we don't typically do. And in fact, I actually had this really cool opportunity to do this. So working with something called the Prostate Network, which is a prostate cancer support group based in Kansas City, whereby myself and one of the members of our metastatic prostate cancer project team Skyped into their monthly meeting and presented the project. Pardon?
That's a great idea. I could think.
And we just connected directly with a small group. We discussed the project. It was clearly sort of a heterogeneous group of guys. Some of whom seemed like they were more helpful, more literate about medical care than others. But we got to connect with all of them. And it was awesome. They were great, and their feedback was awesome. It was a really fun thing to do. And indeed, you know, in our first sort of during the soft launch for this project, over the last few weeks, we have this nice cluster of guys in and around the Kansas City area who have signed up. We're probably all from that one interaction. And I think these are the kinds of things that we could just never dream of doing sort of in a traditional way. It's still hard, though. We still have a lot of work to do to try to be able to sort of with a – be an honest broker in terms of being trustworthy into all the communities that matter to really make this work. But we are really interested in trying to break through that and study men with prostate cancer who have not been traditionally be able to participate in these kinds of research projects.
Well, your enthusiasm is absolutely wonderful to hear, and I thank you for that.
It's easy for me because I get to work with cool people Jan, Prostate Cancer International, Joel, Cancer ABCs, Mike Scott. This has nothing to do profoundly with the project itself, but like on a personal level, the kind of thing where you spend all your time learning how to be a doctor and what it's supposed to mean, and then you get to participate in things like this and realize that you don't know the first thing about about what it's really like. Until you do something like this, and it even actually helped me helped me become a better doctor. That was by no means the intent of this project, and obviously not the primary goal. But I mean, gosh, it's just a privilege to get to engage with this group and do all this fun stuff together.
I think that you feel that way.
So I think we've pretty much reached the end of our time, and Dr. Van Allen, I'd really like to thank you for taking your time out this evening to talk to us all, and I hope it's been interesting to all the people online, and hopefully this will get shared extensively afterwards. A number of our programs do. So, Priya, would you like to wrap us up for the evening?
Thank you, Mike. Yes, I totally resonate with Mike and Dr. Van Allen. Thank you so much for your time and all the information that you shared regarding the metastatic prostate cancer. Thank you so much for being here with us. Mike, Jan, Joel, and Paul, thank you so much for your participation and those great questions. The talk will be made available on CureTalks website, and you can also embed your talks on your websites and blogs now. So please visit curetalks.com for details on our upcoming talks. Have a great evening. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Priya. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.